So I live in a little hermitage up here, and it's not large enough to receive guests. So I come and use this this house here on Sundays when I have Dharma sessions in the morning, and every now and again an English session, and the usual afternoon program. We'll begin with giving a talk, and I think then maybe you have 5 or 10 minutes just to stretch your legs, and then we'll have a meditation session together, following which questions and answers session. Okay? Yes, okay. So... I've been talking non-stop since about 8:30 this morning, so I just have to gather myself.
Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Buddhang dhammang sanghang anuttarang upacayang namasami.
One of the concepts which I believe is missing, or at least is not at all clear or coherent in the Western world, at least as far as I'm aware, is that of the perfected human being, or the idea that of perfection in this imperfect life, or an idea of completeness in an incomplete world. And what is the highest, what is the best that can be hoped for from life in this world? Now that to begin with, that already may be challenged, to say, well, who decides on the criteria? Who decides that one way of life, one way of looking at the world, one way of acting, of thinking, is in any way better than any other way? Isn't that just a matter of opinion? In Buddhism, in Theravada Buddhism in particular, we insist upon the humanity of the Buddha, the historical Buddha. In the Mahayana tradition, the Buddha is often conceived in a much more metaphysical way. In Theravada, we look to the Buddha as a human being, a very special human being, undoubtedly, but one who, through his own efforts, proved exactly what human beings are capable of. So he was enlightened, if you like, as a representative of the human race. And his disciples, both men and women, both monastics and householders, have over the past 2,500 years proved through their own efforts that his enlightenment was not just a fluke, not just a one-off or something that was particular to him, but something which is truly accessible to all human beings. And so the teachings in Theravada Buddhist tradition are concerned primarily with this challenge to realize the full potential of our human birth, following in the footsteps of the Buddha and of his great disciples. So, having the goal of Nibbana or enlightenment, we have a compass, as it were. We have, based upon a belief in the possibility of actualizing or realizing Nibbana, then on that ground we have a criteria for deciding what is good, what is bad, what is right, what is wrong, what is better, what is best. All those actions of body, speech and mind which lead away from the highest goal are considered bad. All those actions of body, speech and mind which lead towards the goal are good. So good and bad, right and wrong, these terms have meanings within the Buddhist tradition in relation to this path towards enlightenment. So enlightenment is conceived not as a special state or as a particular place, but it can be understood most easily in psychological terms as a complete absence of all forms of greed, aversion and delusion. So that's the what we call the via negativa, the negative formulation. The positive formulation is that a perfection, a completeness of wisdom and compassion. There is a third quality usually added to that, although was not taught by the Buddha himself, and that is of purity, meaning a complete freedom, inner freedom from all defilement. So the path is one in which we seek to reduce and overcome the greed and hatred and delusion and all their offspring and children and grandchildren, and to find ways of promoting and nurturing all those qualities that manifest primarily in wisdom and compassion and goodness and freedom. So this is a path which we can characterize as being organic or holistic, in the sense that the different aspects and the different stages are interconnected. Traditionally we speak of a threefold education or a threefold training, the first stage of which is devoted to a training of conduct, the second a training of the emotions, the third the training of wisdom. Now in that three-step or threefold training, the first of conduct is one in which the training of emotion and the training of wisdom is present in a supportive role. In the training of emotion, the training in conduct and wisdom is present also in the background in a supporting role. And the training in wisdom, similarly, must be accompanied by the training in conduct and of emotion in the background. So it's not that there's step one, step two, step three, but in each stage all three aspects are present, but that one takes precedent or is manifest. So, for instance, in the case of the training of conduct, then it's important to recognize that the teachings in the area which we would loosely call morality, although we can immediately see a great deal of overlap with the moral codes of other religious systems, there is something unique to be observed here, and that is that there is no reward and punishment involved, there are no commandments, but that the Buddhist takes on voluntarily the training of conduct. And if there isn't a sense of voluntary commitment, then even though a person might refrain from killing and stealing and so on, he wouldn't be considered to be, or she wouldn't be considered to be, actually actively committed to this education process. Because if we're merely avoiding certain kinds of actions out of fear of the reactions of others, humiliation, criticism, or perhaps even being punished and put into jail, then it would not have the connection with the training of emotion and the training of wisdom which is necessary for it to be a Buddhist morality or a Buddhist sila. So in the ceremony in which lay Buddhists take the five precepts, the ceremony begins with the request for the precepts. And that is significant. There has to be the sense of taking on these precepts as tools to educate our conduct and as objects of mindfulness in daily life. As it's very difficult, isn't it, to maintain any kind of stream of awareness in a very confused and confusing environment where there are constantly varied calls upon our attention. And times when we have to be active, other times we need to be passive, and times we need to talk, and times we need to listen. So many different things going on. And most so-called meditation techniques are not really sustainable in that kind of environment. But what we can be aware of in our daily life, and is a basic grounding in the present moment, are the precepts that we take on as trainings of conduct to refrain from hurting and harming and from stealing and taking what's not given and so on. And these precepts can be refined upon. We can take those as the basic objects of awareness, but we may add on trainings for ourselves in addition to that. For instance, in the case of the third precept of refraining from adultery, you might make a training rule for yourself of not to speak on the telephone or have email conversations with members of the other sex more than a certain number of minutes or more than a certain number of times a month or something. You can make particular private kinds of standards for yourself, which are a very good means of bringing yourself back to the present moment and reminding yourself of your responsibilities and so on.